Kassad dreamed of her often. He had never learned her name. She had never spoken. But he could have recognized her touch and scent in total darkness among a thousand others. He thought of her as mystery. When other young officers went whoring or seeking girlfriends in the indigene populations, Kassad would remain on base or take long walks through strange cities. He kept his obsession with mystery secret, knowing full well how it would read on a psych report. Sometimes, on bivouac under multiple moons, or in the womb-like zero-G of a troop transport hold, Kassad would realize how insane his love affair with a phantom truly was. But then, he would recall the small mole under her left breast, which he had kissed one night, feeling her heartbeat under his lips, as the ground itself shook from the firing of the big guns near Verdun. He would remember the impatient gesture with which she brushed back her hair as her cheek rested on his thigh. And the young officers would go to town or to the huts near the base, and Fedmon Kassad would read another history book or jog along the perimeter, or run tactical strategies on his comlog. It was not long before Kassad came to the attention of his superiors. During the undeclared war with the free miners in the Lambert Ring territories, it was Lieutenant Kassad who led the surviving infantry troops and marine guards in cutting through the bottom of the old asteroid bore shaft on Peregrine to evacuate the hegemony consulate staff and citizens. But it was during the short reign of the new prophet on Qum Riyad that Captain Fedmon Kassad came to the attention of the entire web. The force space captain of the only hegemony ship within 2 leap years of the colony world had been paying a courtesy call when the new prophet chose to lead 30 million New Order Shiites against 2 continents of Sunni shopkeepers and 90,000 resident hegemony infidels. The ship's captain and 5 of his executive officers were taken prisoner. Urgent fatline messages from Tau Ceti Center demanded that the ranking officer aboard the orbiting HS Deneuve settle the situation on Qum Riyad, free all of the hostages, and dispose the new prophet, without resorting to the use of nuclear weapons within the planet's atmosphere. The Deneuve was an aging orbital defense picket. It carried no nuclear weapons that could be used within an atmosphere. The ranking officer on board was Force Combined Captain Fedmon Kassad. On the 3rd day of the revolution, Kassad landed the Deneuve's single assault boat in the main courtyard of the Grand Mosque at Mashhad. He and the other 34 force troopers watched as the mob grew to 300,000 militants kept at bay only by the boat's containment field and the lack of an order to attack by the new prophet. The new prophet himself was no longer in the Grand Mosque. He had flown to the northern hemisphere of Riyadh to join in the victory celebrations there. 2 hours after he landed, Captain Kassad stepped out of his ship and broadcast a short announcement. He said that he had been raised as a Muslim. He also announced that the interpretation of the Quran since the Shiites' seedship days had definitely shown that the God of Islam would neither condone nor allow the slaughter of the innocent, no matter how many jihads were proclaimed by tin-horned heretics like the new prophet. Captain Kassad gave the leaders of the 30 million zealots 3 hours to surrender their hostages and return to their homes on the desert continent of Qum. In the first 3 days of the revolution, the armies of the new prophet had occupied most of the cities on 2 continents and had taken more than 27,000 hegemony hostages. Firing squads had been busy day and night settling ancient theological disputes, and it was estimated that at least 250,000 Sunnis had been slaughtered in the first 2 days of the new prophet's occupation. In response to Kassad's ultimatum, the new prophet announced that all of the infidels would be put to death immediately following his live television address that evening. He also ordered an attack on Kassad's assault boat. Avoiding high explosives because of the Grand Mosque, the Revolutionary Guard used automatic weapons, crude energy cannon, plasma charges, and human wave attacks. The containment field held. The new prophet's televised address began 15 minutes before Kassad's ultimatum ran out. The new prophet agreed with Kassad's statement that Allah would horribly punish heretics, but announced that it was the hegemony infidels who would be so punished. It was the only time the new prophet ever had been seen to lose his temper on camera. Screaming, saliva flying, he ordered the human wave attacks to be renewed on the grounded assault boat. He announced that at that moment, a dozen fission bombs were being assembled at the occupied Power for Peace reactor in Ali. With these, the forces of Allah would be carried into space itself. The first fission bomb, he explained, would be used on the infidel Kassad's satanic assault boat that very afternoon. The new prophet then began to explain exactly how the hegemony hostages would be executed. But, at that moment, Kassad's deadline ran out. Qum Riyad was, by its own choice and the accident of its distant location, a technically primitive world. But the inhabitants were not so primitive that they did not have an active datasphere. Nor were the revolutionary mullahs who had led the invasion so opposed to the great Satan of hegemony science that they refused to tie into the global data net with their personal comm logs. The HS Deniev had seeded enough spy sats so that by 1729 hours, Qum Riyad Central Time, the datasphere had been tapped to the point that the hegemony ship had identified 16,830 revolutionary mullahs by their access codes. At 1729:30 hours, the spy sats began feeding their real-time targeting data to the 21 perimeter defense sats which Kassad's assault boat had left in low orbit. These orbital defense weapons were so old that the Deniev's mission had been to return them to the web for safe destruction. Kassad had suggested another use for them. At precisely 1730 hours, 19 of the small satellites detonated their fusion cores. In the nanoseconds before their self-destruction, the resulting X-rays were focused, aimed, and released in 16,830 invisible but very coherent beams. The ancient defense sats were not designed for atmospheric use and had an effective destructive radius of less than a millimeter. Luckily, that was all that was needed. Not all of the targeting beams penetrated whatever stood between the mullahs and the sky. 15,784 did. The effect was immediate and dramatic. In each case, the target's brain and cerebral fluid boiled, turned to vapor, and blew the encasing skull to bits. The new prophet was in the middle of his live planet-wide broadcast, literally in the middle of pronouncing the word heretic, when 1730 hours arrived. For almost 2 minutes, the TV screens and walls around the planet carried the image of the new prophet's headless body slumped over the microphone. Then, Fedman Kassad cut in on all bands to announce that his next deadline was 1 hour away and that any actions against the hostages would be met with a more dramatic demonstration of Allah's displeasure. There were no reprisals. That night, in orbit around Qum Riyad, mystery visited Kassad for the first time since his cadet days. He was asleep, but the visit was more than a dream, and less than the alternative reality of the OCS-HTN sims. The woman and he were lying together under a light blanket beneath a broken roof. Her skin was warm and electric, her face little more than a pale outline against nighttime darkness. Overhead, the stars had just begun to fade into the false light of pre-dawn. Kassad realized that she was trying to speak to him. Her soft lips formed words which were just below the threshold of Kassad's hearing. He pulled back a second in order to see her face better and, in so doing, lost contact completely. He awoke in his sleep webbing with moisture on his cheeks and the hum of the ship's systems sounding as strange to him as the breathing of some half-awakened beast. 9 standard ship weeks later, Cassad stood before a forced court-martial review on Freeholm. He had known when he made his decision on Qum Riyad that his superiors would have no choice but to crucify or promote him. Force prided itself on preparing itself for all contingencies in the web or the colonial regions, but nothing had properly prepared it for the Battle of South Brescia and its implications for the New Bushido. The New Bushido Code, which governed Colonel Cassad's life, had evolved out of the necessity for the military class to survive. After the obscenities of the late 20th and early 21st centuries on old Earth, when military leaders had committed their nations to strategies wherein entire civilian populations were legitimate targets, while their uniformed executioners sat safe in self-contained bunkers 50 meters under the earth, the repugnance of the surviving civilians was so great that for more than a century the word military was an invitation to a lynching. As the New Bushido evolved, it combined the age-old concepts of honor and individual courage with the need to spare civilians whenever possible. It also saw the wisdom of returning to the pre-Napoleonic concepts of small, non-total wars with defined goals and prescribed excesses. The code demanded a forsaking of nuclear weapons and strategic bombing campaigns in all but the most extreme cases, but more than that, it demanded a return to old Earth medieval concepts of set battles between small professional forces at a mutually agreed upon time in a place where destruction of public and private property would be kept to a minimum. This code worked well for the first four centuries of post-Hegira expansion. The fact that essential technologies were essentially frozen in place for three of those centuries worked in the hegemony's favor, as its monopoly on the use of farcasters allowed it to apply the modest resources of force at the right place in the required amount of time. Even when separated by the inevitable leap years of time debt, no colonial or independent world could hope to match the power of the hegemony. Incidents such as the political rebellion on Maui Covenant with its unique guerrilla warfare, or the religious insanity on Qum Riyad were put down quickly and firmly, and any excesses in the campaigns merely pointed out the importance of returning to the strict code of the New Bushido. But for all of Force's calculations and preparations, no one had adequately planned on the inevitable confrontation with the ousters. The ousters had been the single external threat to the hegemony for the four centuries since the forebears of the barbarian hordes had left Sol System in their crude fleet of leaking O'Neill cities, tumbling asteroids, and experimental comet farm clusters. Even after the ousters acquired the Hawking Drive, it remained official hegemony policy to ignore them as long as their swarms stayed in the darkness between the stars, and limited their in-system plunderings to scooping small amounts of hydrogen from gas giants and water ice from uninhabited moons. The early outback skirmishes, such as Bent's World and GHC 2990, were considered aberrations of little interest to the hegemony. Even the pitched battle for Lee 3 had been treated as a colonial service problem, and when the Force Task Force arrived 6 local years after the attack, 5 years after the ousters departed, any atrocities were conveniently forgotten in favor of the view that no barbarian raid would repeat itself when the hegemony chose to flex its muscle. In the decades which followed Lee 3, Force and ouster space forces skirmished in 100 border areas, but except for the odd marine encounters in airless, weightless places, there were no infantry confrontations. Stories in the world web proliferated. The ousters would never be a threat to Earth-like worlds because of their 3 centuries of adaptation to weightlessness. The ousters had evolved into something more or less than human. The ousters did not have farcaster technology, would never have it, and thus would never be a threat to Force. Then came Brescia. Brescia was one of those smug, independent worlds, pleased with both its convenient access to the web and its 8-month separation from it, growing rich from the export of diamonds, burr root, and its unequaled coffee. coyly refusing to become a colony world, but still dependent on the hegemony protectorate and common market to meet its soaring economic goals. As with most such worlds, Brescia was proud of its self-defense force, 12 torch ships, a refitted attack carrier which had been decommissioned by Force Space half a century earlier, 20 or more of small, fast orbital patrol vessels, a standing army of 90,000 volunteers, a respectable ocean-going navy, and a store of nuclear weapons stockpiled purely for symbolic purposes. The ouster Hawkingwake had been noticed by hegemony monitoring stations, but was misinterpreted as merely another swarm migration which would pass no closer than half a light year to the Brescian system. Instead, with a single course correction, which was not detected until the swarm was within the Oort cloud radius, the ousters fell on Brescia like some Old Testament plague. A minimum of 7 standard months separated Brescia from any hegemony rescue or response. Brescia's space force was obliterated within the first 20 hours of fighting. The ouster swarm then put more than 3,000 ships into Brescia's cislunar space and began the systematic reduction of all planetary defenses. The world had been settled by no-nonsense Central Europeans in the first wave of the Hegira, and its two continents bore the prosaic names of North Brescia and South Brescia. North Brescia held desert, high tundra, and 6 major cities, housing mostly burr-root harvesters and petroleum engineers. South Brescia, much more temperate in climate and geography, was the home for most of the world's 400 million people and the huge coffee plantations. As if to demonstrate what war had once been about, the ousters scoured North Brescia. First, with several hundred fallout-free nuclear weapons and tactical plasma bombs, then with death beams, and finally with tailored viruses. Only a handful of the 14 million residents escaped. South Brescia received no bombardment, except for the lancing of specific military targets, airports, and the large harbor at Solno. Force doctrine held that, while a world could be reduced from orbit, actual military invasion of an industrialized planet was an impossibility. The problems with landing logistics, the immense area to be occupied, and the unwieldy size of the invading army were considered to be the ultimate arguments against invasion. The ousters obviously had not read the Force Doctrine books. On the 23rd day of the investiture, more than 2,000 dropships and assault boats fell on South Brescia. What was left of the Brescian Air Force was destroyed in those first hours of the invasion. 2 nuclear devices were actually detonated against ouster staging areas. The first was deflected by energy fields, and the second destroyed a single scout ship which may have been a decoy. Ousters, it turned out, had changed physically in 3 centuries. They did prefer zero-gravity environments, but their mobile infantry's powered exoskeletons served very well, and it was only a matter of days before the black-clad, long-limbed ouster troops were swarming over South Brescia's cities like an infestation of giant spiders. The last organized resistance collapsed on the 19th day of the invasion. Buckminster, the capital, fell the same day. The last fat-line message from Brescia to the hegemony was cut off in mid-transmission, an hour after ouster troops entered the city. Colonel Fedmon Kassad arrived with Force Fleet 1 29 standard weeks later. 30 Omega-class torch ships protecting a single Farcaster-equipped jump ship penetrated the system at high speed. The Singularity Sphere was activated 3 hours after spinning down, and 10 hours after that, there were 400 Force ships of the line in system. The counter-invasion began 21 hours later. Those were the mathematics of the first minutes of the Battle of Brescia. For Kassad, the memory of those days and weeks held not mathematics, but the terrible beauty of combat. It was the first time jump ships had been used on anything above a division level, and there was the expected confusion. Kassad went through from 5 light minutes out, and fell into gravel and yellow dust, because the assault boat Farcaster portal was facing down a steep incline made slick with mud and the blood of the first squads through. Kassad lay in the mud and looked down the hillside at madness. 10 of the 17 Farcaster assault boats were down and burning, scattered across the foothills and plantation fields like broken toys. The containment fields of the surviving boats were shrinking under an onslaught of missile and CPB fire that turned the landing areas into domes of orange flame. Kassad's tactical display was a hopeless mess. His visor showed a garble of impossible fire vectors, blinking red phosphors where force troops lay dying, and overlays of ouster jamming ghosts. Someone was screaming, "Oh, God damn it! God damn it! Oh, God damn it!" on his primary command circuit, and the implants registered a void where command group's data should be. An enlisted man helped him up. Kassad flicked mud off his command wand and got out of the way of the next squad farcasting through. And the war was on. From his first minutes on South Brescia, Kassad realized that the new Bushido was dead. 80,000 superbly armed and trained force ground troops advanced from their staging areas, seeking battle in an unpopulated place. Ouster force retreated behind a line of scorched earth, leaving only booby traps and dead civilians. Force used Farcasters to outmaneuver the enemy, to force him to fight. The ousters responded with a barrage of nuclear and plasma weapons, pinning the ground troops under force fields, while the ouster infantry retreated to prepare defenses around cities and dropship staging areas. There were no quick victories in space to shift the balance on South Brescia. Despite feints and occasional fierce battles, the ousters retained complete control of everything within 3 AU of Brescia. Force space units fell back and concentrated on keeping the fleet within Farcaster range and protecting the primary jump ship. What had been forecast as a 2-day battle ground on for 30 days, then 60. Warfare had been thrown back to the 20th or 21st century. Long, grim campaigns fought through the brick dust of ruined cities, over the corpses of civilians. The 80,000 original force troops were ground up, reinforced with 100,000 more, and were still being decimated when the call went out for 200,000 more. Only the grim resolve of Mena Gladstone and a dozen other determined senators kept the war alive, and the troops dying, while the billions of voices of the All Thing and the AI Advisory Council called for disengagement. Kassad had understood the change of tactics almost at once. His street-fighting instincts had risen to the forefront, even before most of his division was wiped out in the Battle of the Stone Heap. While other force commanders were all but ceasing to function, frozen into indecision by this violation of the new Bushido, Kassad, in command of his regiment and in temporary command of his division after the nuking of Command Group Delta, was trading men for time and calling for the release of fusion weapons to spearhead his own counterattack. By the time the ousters withdrew, 97 days after the force rescue of Brescia, Kassad had earned the double-edged nickname of the Butcher of South Brescia. It was rumored that even his own troops were afraid of him. And Kassad dreamed of her with dreams that were more and less than dreams. On the last night of the battle for Stoneheap, in the maze of dark tunnels where Kassad and his hunter-killer groups used sonics and T5 gas to flush out the last warrens of ouster commandos, the colonel fell asleep amid the flame and screams, and felt the touch of her long fingers on his cheek, and the soft compression of her breasts against him. When they entered New Vienna on the morning after the space strike Kassad had called in, the troops following the glass-smooth, 20-meter-wide burn grooves into the lanced city, Kassad had stared without blinking at the rows of human heads lying on the pavement, carefully lined up as if to welcome the rescuing force troops with their accusatory stares. Kassad had returned to his command EMV, closed the hatches, and, curling up in the warm darkness smelling of rubber, heated plastics, charged ions, had heard her whispers over the babble of the C3 channels and implant coding. On the night before the ouster retreat, Kassad left the command conference on the HS Brazil, Farcast to his HQ in the Indelibles north of the Hein Valley, and took his command car to the summit to watch the final bombardment. The nearest of the tactical nuclear strikes was 45 kilometers away. The plasma bombs blossomed like orange and blood-red flowers planted in a perfect grid. Kassad counted more than 200 dancing columns of green light as the hellwhip lances ripped the broad plateau to shreds. And even before he slept, while he sat on the flare skirt of the EMV and shook pale after images from his eyes, she came. She wore a pale blue dress and walked lightly between the dead burr root plants on the hillside. The breeze lifted the hem of the soft fabric of her dress. Her face and arms were pale, almost translucent. She called his name. He could almost hear the words. And then, the second wave of bombardment rolled in across the plain below him, and everything was lost in noise and flame. As tends to be the case in a universe apparently ruled by irony, Fedmon Kassad passed unscathed through 97 days of the worst fighting the hegemony had ever seen, only to be wounded 2 days after the last of the ousters had retreated to their fleeing swarm ships. He was in the Civic Center building in Buckminster, one of the only 3 buildings left standing in the city, giving curt answers to stupid questions from a World Web news steep when a plasma booby trap no larger than a micro switch exploded 15 floors above, blew the news steep and 2 of Kassad's aides through a ventilator grill into the street beyond, and dropped the building on him. Kassad was medevaced to Division HQ, and then farcast to the jump ship now in orbit around Brescia's second moon. There, he was resuscitated and put on full life support while the military brass and hegemony politicians decided what to do with him. Because of the farcaster connection and the real-time media coverage of Brescia, Colonel Fedmon Kassad had become somewhat of a cause célèbre. Those billions who had been appalled by the unprecedented savagery of the South Brescia campaign would have been pleased to see Kassad court-martialed or tried for war crimes. CEO Gladstone and many others considered Kassad and the other force commanders as saviors. In the end, Kassad was put on a hospital spin ship for the slow trip back to the web. Since most of the physical repair would be done in fugue anyway, it made some sense to let the old hospital ships work on the seriously wounded and the revivable dead. By the time Kassad and the other patients reached the World Web, they would be ready for active duty. More importantly, Kassad would have accrued a time debt of at least 18 standard months, and whatever controversy surrounded him might well be over by that time. Kassad awoke to see the dark shape of a woman bending over him. For a second, he was sure that it was she, and then he realized that it was a force medic.
"Am I dead?" he whispered.
"You were. You're on the HS Merrick. You've been through resuscitation and renewal several times, but you probably don't remember because of the fugue hangover. We're ready to start the next step in physical therapy. Do you feel like trying to walk?"
Kassad lifted his arm to cover his eyes. Even through the disorientation of fugue state, he now remembered the painful therapy sessions, the long hours in the RNA virus baths, and the surgery. Most of all, the surgery.
"What's our route?" he asked, still shielding his eyes. "I forget how we're getting back to the web."
The medic smiled as if this were a question he asked each time he came out of fugue. Perhaps it was.
"We'll be putting in at Hyperion and Garden," she said. "We're just entering the orbit of..."
The woman was interrupted by the sound of the end of the world. Great brass trumpets blowing,
metal ripping, furies screaming. Kassad rolled off the bed, wrapping the mattress around him as he fell in the 1/6 G. Hurricane winds slid him across the deck and hurled pitchers, trays, bedclothes, books, bodies, metal instruments, and countless other objects at him. Men and women were screaming, their voices rising through falsetto as the air rushed out of the ward. Kassad felt the mattress slam into the wall. He looked out between clenched fists. A meter from him, a football-sized spider with wildly waving legs was trying to force itself into a crack which had suddenly appeared in the bulkhead. The thing's jointless legs seemed to be swatting at the paper and other detritus whirling around it. The spider rotated, and Kassad realized that it was the head of the medic. She had been decapitated in the initial explosion. Her long hair writhed at Kassad's face. Then, the crack widened to the width of a fist, and the head disappeared through it. Kassad pulled himself up just as the boom arm quit spinning and up ceased to be. The only forces now in play were the hurricane winds still flinging everything in the ward toward the cracks and gaps in the bulkhead, and the sickening lurch and tumble of the ship. Kassad swam against it all, pulling himself toward the door to the boom arm corridor, using every handhold he could find, kicking free the last 5 meters. A metal tray struck him above the eye. A corpse with hemorrhaged eyes almost tumbled him back into the ward. The airtight emergency doors were slamming uselessly into a dead Marine whose space-suited body blocked the seal from closing. Kassad rolled through into the boom arm shaft and pulled the corpse after him. The door sealed behind him. But there was no more air in the shaft than there had been in the ward. Somewhere, a klaxon scream thinned to inaudibility. Kassad also screamed, trying to relieve the pressure so that his lungs and eardrums would not burst. The boom arm was still draining air. He and the corpse were being sucked the 130 meters to the main body of the ship. He and the dead Marine tumbled along the boom arm shaft in a grisly waltz. It took Kassad 20 seconds to slap open the emergency releases on the Marine's suit. Another minute to eject the man's corpse and get his own body in. He was at least 10 centimeters taller than the dead man, and although the suit was built to allow some expansion, it still pinched painfully at his neck and wrists and knees. The helmet squeezed his forehead like a cushioned vice. Gobbets of blood and a moist white material clung to the inside of the visor. The piece of shrapnel which had killed the Marine had left entrance and exit holes, but the suit had done its best to seal itself. Most of the chest lights were red, and the suit did not respond when Kassad ordered it to give a status report, but the rebreather worked, although with a worrying rasp. Kassad tried the suit radio. Nothing. Not even background static. He found the comm log lead, jacked into a hull termix. Nothing. The ship pitched again then, metal reverberating to a succession of blows, and Kassad was thrown against the wall of the boom arm shaft. One of the transport cages tumbled by, its severed cables whipping like the tentacles of an agitated sea anemone. There were corpses in the cage and more bodies tangled along the segments of spiral staircase still intact along the shaft wall. Kassad kicked the remaining distance to the end of the shaft and found all of the airtight doors there sealed. The boom arm shaft itself irised shut. But there were holes in the primary bulkhead large enough to drive a commercial EMV through. The ship lurched again and began to tumble more wildly, imparting complex new Coriolis forces to Kassad and everything else in the shaft. Kassad hung on torn metal and pulled himself through a rent in the triple hull of the HS Merrick. He almost laughed when he saw the interior. Whoever had lanced the old hospital ship had done it right, chopping and stabbing the hull with CPBs until pressure seals failed, self-seal units ruptured, damage control remotes overloaded, and the interior bulkheads collapsed. Then the enemy ship had put missiles into the guts of the Hulk, with warheads of what the Force space people quaintly called canister shot. The effect had been quite similar to setting off an anti-personnel grenade in a crowded rat maze. Lights shone through a thousand holes, here and there becoming colorful rays where they found a colloidal base in floating haze of dust or blood or lubricant. From where Kassad hung, twisting with the lurch and tumble of the ship, he could see a score or more of bodies, naked and torn, each moving with the deceptive underwater ballet grace of the zero-gravity dead. Most of the corpses floated within their own small solar systems of blood and tissue. Several of them watched Kassad with the cartoon character stares of their pressure-expanded eyes, and seemed to beckon him closer with random, languid movements of arms and hands. Kassad kicked through the wreckage to reach the main drop shaft to the command core. He had seen no weapons. It seemed that no one except the Marine had managed to suit up. But he knew that there would be a weapons locker in the command core, or in the Marine quarters aft. Kassad stopped at the last torn pressure seal and stared. He did laugh this time. Beyond this point, there was no main drop shaft, no aft section. There was no ship. This section, a boom arm and medical ward mod, a ragged chunk of the hull, had been ripped free of the ship as easily as Beowulf had torn the arm from Grendel's body. The final, unsealed doorway to the drop shaft led to open space. Some kilometers away, Kassad could see a dozen other ravaged fragments of the HS Merrick tumbling in the glare of sunlight. A green and lapis planet loomed so close that Kassad felt a surge of acrophobia and clung more tightly to the doorframe. Even as he watched, a star moved above the limb of the planet. Laser weapons winked their ruby morse. And a gutted ship section half a kilometer away across the gulf of vacuum from Kassad burst again in a gout of vaporized metal, freezing volatiles and tumbling black specks which Kassad realized were bodies. Kassad pulled himself deeper into the concealing tangle of wreckage and considered his situation. The Marine suit could not last more than another hour. Already Kassad could smell the rotten egg's stench of the malfunctioning rebreather. He had seen no airtight compartment or container during his struggle through the wreckage. And even if he found a closet or airlock to shelter in, what then? Kassad did not know if the planet below was Hyperion or Garden, but he was sure that there was no Force presence on either world. He was also quite sure that no local defense forces would challenge an ouster warship. It would be days before any patrol craft investigated the wreckage. It was quite possible, Kassad knew, that the orbit of the tumbling piece of junk he now inhabited would decay before they sent anyone up to check on it, sending thousands of tons of twisted metal burning through the atmosphere. The locals would not like that, Kassad knew, but from their point of view, it might be preferable to let a bit of sky fall than to antagonize the ousters. If the planet had primitive orbital defenses or ground-based CPBs, he realized, with a grim smile, it would make more sense for them to blast the wreckage than to fire on the ouster ship. It would make no difference to Kassad. Unless he did something quickly, he would be dead long before the remnants of the ship entered atmosphere or the locals took action. The Marine's amplification shield had been cracked by the shrapnel which had killed him. But now Kassad tugged what was left of the viewplate down over the visor. Telltales winked red, but there was still enough suit power to show the amplified view glowing pale green through the spiderweb of cracks. Kassad watched as the ouster torch ship stood off 100 clicks, its defense fields blurring background stars, and launched several objects. For an instant, Kassad was sure that these were the coup de grace missiles, and he found himself grinning joylessly at the certainty of having only a few seconds to live. Then, he noticed their low velocity and notched the amplification higher. The power lights blinked red, and the amplifier failed, but not before Kassad had seen the tapering ovoid shapes, spotted with thrusters and cockpit blisters, each trailing a tangle of six jointless manipulator arms. Squids, the Force space people had called the ouster boarding craft. Kassad pulled himself farther back in the wreckage. He had only a few minutes before one or more of the squids reached his piece of the ship. How many ousters would one of those things carry? 10? 20? Kassad was sure that it would be no fewer than 10, and they would be well-armed and rigged with infrared and motion sensors. The elite ouster equivalent of Hegemony Space Marines, the commandos would not only have been trained for free-fall combat, but had been born and bred to zero-G. Their long limbs, prehensile toes, and prosthetic tails would be added advantages for this environment, although Kassad doubted that they needed any more advantages than they already had. He began to pull himself carefully back through the labyrinth of twisted metal, fighting the adrenaline fear surge that made him want to kick off screaming through the darkness. What did they want? Prisoners. That would solve his immediate survival problem. All he had to do was survive and surrender. The difficulty with that solution was that Kassad had seen the Force intelligence hollows of the ouster ship they had captured off Brescia. There had been more than 200 prisoners in the storage bay of that ship, and the ousters obviously had many questions for these Hegemony citizens. Perhaps they had found it inconvenient to feed and imprison so many, or perhaps it was their basic interrogation policy. But the fact was that the Brescian civilians and captured Force troops had been found flayed open and pinned down on steel trays like frogs in a biology lab, their organs bathed with nutrient fluids, arms and legs efficiently amputated, eyes removed, and their minds readied for interrogators' questions with crude cortical comm taps and shunt plugs jacked directly through 3-centimeter holes in the skulls. Kassad pulled himself along, floating through debris and the tangled entrails of the ship's wiring. He felt no inclination whatsoever to surrender. The tumbling hulk vibrated and then steadied some as at least one of the squids attached itself to the hull or bulkhead. "Think," Kassad commanded. He needed a weapon more than a hiding place. Had he seen anything during his crawl through the wreckage that would help him survive? Kassad stopped moving and hung from an exposed section of fiber optic cable while he thought. The medical ward where he had awakened, beds, fugue tanks, intensive care apparatus, most of it expelled through the breaches in the spin mod's hull. Boom arm shaft, elevator cage, corpses on the stairs. No weapons. Most of the bodies had been stripped by the canister shot explosions or sudden decompression. The elevator cables? No, too long. Impossible to sever without tools. Tools. He had seen none. The medical offices flayed open along the corridors beyond the main drop shaft. Medical imaging rooms, MRI tanks, and CPD bays flung open like looted sarcophagi. At least one operating room intact, its interior maze of scattered instruments and floating cables. The solarium, scraped clean when the windows exploded outward. Patient lounges, medics lounges, the scrub rooms, corridors, and unidentifiable cubicles. The corpses. Kassad hung there a second longer, oriented himself in the tumbling maze of light and shadow, and then kicked off. He had hoped for 10 minutes. He was given less than 8. He knew that the ousters would be methodical and efficient, but had underestimated how efficient they could be in zero-G. He gambled his life that there would be at least 2 of them on each sweep, basic Space Marine procedure, much as Force ground jump rats had learned to go door to door in city fighting, one to burst into each room, the other to provide cover fire. If there were more than 2, if the ousters worked in squads of 4, Kassad almost certainly would be dead. He was floating in the middle of Operating Room 3 when the ouster came through the door. Kassad's rebreather had all but failed. He was floating, immobile, gasping foul air, as the ouster commando swung in, swung aside, and brought his two weapons to bear on the unarmed figure in a battered marine spacesuit. Kassad had bargained that the gruesome condition of his suit and visor would gain him a second or two. Behind his gore-smeared faceplate, Kassad's eyes stared sightlessly upward as the ouster's chest light swept across him. The commando carried two weapons, a sonic stunner in one hand and a smaller but much more lethal tight-beam pistol in the long toes of his left foot. He raised the sonic. Kassad had time to notice the killing spike on the prosthetic tail. And then he triggered the mouse in his gauntleted right hand. It had taken Kassad most of his 8 minutes to tie in the emergency generator to the operating room circuits. Not all of the surgery lasers had survived, but six still worked. Kassad had positioned four of the smaller ones to cover the area just to the left of the doorway, the two bone cutters to target the space to the right. The ouster had moved to the right. The ouster's suit exploded. The lasers continued to slice away in their pre-programmed circles as Kassad propelled himself forward, ducking under the blue beams now swirling in a spreading mist of useless suit sealant and boiling blood. He wrested the sonic away just as the second ouster swung into the room, agile as an old earth chimp. Kassad pressed the sonic against the man's helmet and fired. The suited figure went limp. The prosthetic tail spasmed a few times from random nerve impulses. Triggering the sonic that close was no way to take a prisoner. A burst from that distance turned a human brain into something resembling oatmeal mush. Kassad did not want to take a prisoner. He kicked free, grabbed a girder, swept the active sonic across the open doorway. No one else came through. A check 20 seconds later showed an empty corridor. Kassad ignored the first body and stripped the man with the intact suit. The commando was naked under the spacesuit, and it turned out not to be a man. The female commando had short-cropped blonde hair, small breasts, and a tattoo just above her line of pubic hair. She was very pale, and droplets of blood floated from her nose, ears, and eyes. Kassad made a note that the ousters used women in their marines. All of the ouster bodies on Brescia had been male. He kept his helmet and rebreather pack on as he kicked the body aside and tugged on the unfamiliar suit. Vacuum exploded blood vessels in his flesh. Deep cold nipped at him as he struggled with strange clasps and locks. Tall as he was too short for the woman's suit. He could operate the hand gauntlets by stretching, but the foot gloves and tail connections were hopeless. He let them hang useless as he bailed out of his own helmet and wrestled the ouster bubble into place. Lights in the collar disky glowed amber and violet. Kassad heard the rush of air through aching eardrums and almost gagged as a thick, rich stench assailed him. He assumed it was the sweet smell of home to an ouster. Earphone patches in the bubble whispered coded commands in a language which sounded like an audio tape of ancient English played backward at high speed. Kassad was gambling again, this time on the fact that ouster ground units on Brescia had functioned as semi-independent teams, united by voice radio and basic telemetry, rather than a force ground type of tactical implant web. If they used the same system here, then the commando leader might know that two of his or her troops were missing. Possibly even have medcom readings on them, but might not know exactly where they were. Kassad decided that it was time to quit hypothesizing and to get moving. He programmed the mouse to have the surgical lasers fire on anything entering the operating room, and then Bounce stumbled his way down the corridor. Moving in one of these damn suits, he thought, was like trying to walk in a gravity field while standing on your own trousers. He had brought along both energy pistols and, finding no belt, lock rings, hooks, Velcro pads, mag clamps, or pockets to secure them with. Now floated along like some drunken holodrama pirate, a weapon in each hand, bouncing from wall to wall. Reluctantly, he left one pistol floating behind him while he tried to hook himself along one-handed. The gauntlet fit like a size 15 mitten on a size 2 hand. The damn tail wobbled, banged against his helmet bubble, and was a literal pain in the ass. Twice he squeezed into crevices when he saw lights in the distance. He was just about to the deck opening where he had watched the squid approach, when he rounded a corner and almost floated into three ouster commandos. The fact that he was wearing an ouster suit gave him at least a 2-second advantage. He shot the first suited figure in the helmet at point-blank range. The second man, or woman, fired a wild sonic burst past Kassad's left shoulder, a second before he put three bolts into the ouster's chest plate. The third commando flipped backward, found three handholds, and was out of sight around a broken bulkhead before Kassad could retarget. His headset rang with curses, commands, and questions. Kassad gave silent chase. The third ouster would have escaped if he had not rediscovered honor and turned to fight. Kassad felt an inexplicable sense of déjà vu as he put an energy bolt through the man's left eye from 5 meters away. The corpse tumbled backward into sunlight. Kassad pulled himself to the opening and stared at the squid moored not 20 meters away. It was, he thought, the first undiluted piece of luck he had had in some time. He kicked across the gap, knowing that if someone wanted to shoot him from the squid or the wreckage, there was nothing he could do about it. He felt the scrotum-lifting tension he always experienced when he was an obvious target. No shots were fired. Commands and interrogatives squawked in his ears. He could not understand them, did not know where they originated, and, on the whole, thought it best if he stayed out of the dialogue. The clumsiness of the suit almost caused him to miss the squid. He thought briefly that such an anticlimax would be the universe's fitting verdict on his martial pretensions. The brave warrior floating off into near-planet orbit, no maneuvering systems, no propellant, no reaction mass of any sort. Even the pistol was non-recoil. He would end his life as useless and harmless as a child's runaway balloon. Kassad stretched until his joints popped, caught a whip antenna, and pulled himself hand over hand into the squid's hull. Where the hell was the airlock? The hull was relatively smooth for a spacefaring vessel, but was decorated with a riot of designs, decals, and panels announcing what he assumed were the ouster equivalents of no-step and danger thruster port. No entrances were visible. He guessed that there were ousters on board, a pilot at least, and that they were probably wondering why their returning commando was crawling around the hull like a spavined crab rather than cycling the airlock. Or perhaps they knew why, and were waiting inside with drawn pistols. At any rate, it was obvious that no one was going to open the door for him. To hell with it, thought Kassad, and shot out one of the observation blisters. The ousters kept a tidy ship, not much more than the equivalent of a few lost paper clips and coins geysered out with the ship's air. Kassad waited until the eruption had died down and squeezed through the gap. He was in the carrier section, a cushioned hold looking a lot like the jump rat bay of any dropship or APC. Kassad made a mental note that a squid probably held about 20 ouster commandos in full vacuum combat gear. Now it was empty. An open hatch led to the cockpit. Only the command pilot had remained on board, and he was in the final process of unbelting when Kassad shot him. Kassad pushed the body into the carrier section and strapped himself into what he hoped was the command chair. Warm sunlight came through the blister above him. Video monitors and console hollows showed scenes from dead ahead, astern, and shoulder camera glimpses of the search operation inside. Kassad caught a glimpse of the nude body in operating room 3 and several figures in a firefight with surgical lasers. In the hollow dramas of Fedmon Kassad's childhood, heroes always seem to know how to operate skimmers, spacecraft, exotic EMVs, and other strange machinery whenever the need arose. Kassad had been trained to handle military transports, simple tanks, and APCs, even an assault boat or dropship if he was desperate. If stranded on a runaway force spacecraft, a remote possibility, he could find his way around the command course efficiently to communicate with the primary computer or put out a distress call on a radio or fatline transmitter. Sitting in the command chair of an ouster squid, Kassad did not have a clue. That was not quite true. He immediately recognized the remote grip slots for the squid's tentacle manipulators, and given 2 or 3 hours of thought and inspection, he might have figured out several other controls. He did not have the time. The forward screen showed 3 space-suited figures jumping for the squid, firing as they came. The pale, oddly alien head of an ouster commander suddenly materialized on the hollow console. Kassad heard shouts from his bubble ear patches. Globules of sweat hung in front of his eyes and streaked the inside of his helmet. He shook them away as best he could, squinted at the control consoles, and pushed several likely-looking surfaces. If there were voice command circuits, override controls, or a suspicious ship's computer, Kassad knew, he was screwed. He had thought of all this in the second or two before he shot the pilot, but had not been able to think of a way to coerce or trust the man. No, this had to be the way, thought Kassad, even as he tapped more control surfaces. A thruster began firing. The squid pulled and tugged at its moorings. Kassad bounced back and forth in his webbing. "Shit," he whispered, his first audible comment since he had asked the force medic where the ship was putting in. He strained far enough forward to get his gauntleted fingers into the grip slots. 4 of the 6 manipulators released. 1 ripped off. The final one tore away a chunk of bulkhead from the HS Merrick. The squid tumbled free. Video cameras showed 2 of the space-suited figures missing their jumps, the 3rd clutching at the same whip antenna which had saved Kassad. Knowing roughly where the thruster controls were now, Kassad tapped in a frenzy. An overhead light came on. All of the holo projectors went dead. The squid commenced in a maneuver which incorporated all of the most violent elements of pitch, roll, and yaw. Kassad saw the spacesuited form tumble past the overhead blister, appear briefly on the forward video screen, become a speck on the aft screen. The ouster was still firing energy bolts as he, or she, became too small to see. Kassad struggled to stay conscious as the violent tumbling continued. Various voice and visual alarms were screaming for his attention. Kassad tapped at thruster controls, considered it a success, and pulled his hands away when he felt as if he were being pulled apart in only 2 directions rather than 5. A random camera shot showed him that the torch ship was receding. Good. Kassad had no doubt that the ouster warship could destroy him at any second, and that it would if he approached or threatened it in any way. He did not know if the squid was armed, personally doubted if it would carry anything larger than anti-personnel weapons, but he knew beyond a doubt that no torch ship commander would allow an out-of-control shuttlecraft to come anywhere near his ship. Kassad assumed that the ousters all knew by now that the squid had been hijacked by the enemy. He would not be surprised, disappointed, but not surprised, if the torch ship vaporized him at any second. But in the meantime, he was counting on 2 emotions that were quintessentially human, if not necessarily ouster human. Curiosity and the desire for revenge. Curiosity, he knew, could easily be overridden in times of stress. But he counted on a paramilitary, semi-feudal culture like the ousters to be deeply involved with revenge. Everything else being equal, with no chance to hurt them further and almost no chance to escape, it would seem that Colonel Fedmon Kassad had become a prime candidate for one of their dissection trays. He hoped so. Kassad looked at the forward video display, frowned, and loosened his harness long enough to look out the overhead blister. The ship was tumbling, but not nearly so violently as before. The planet seemed closer. One hemisphere filled the view above him. But he had no idea how close the squid was to atmosphere. He could read none of the data displays. He could only guess what their orbital velocity had been and how violent a re-entry shock would be. His one long glimpse from the wreckage of the Merrick had suggested to Kassad that they were very close, perhaps only 500 or 600 clicks above the surface, and in the kind of parking orbit which he knew preceded the launching of dropships. Kassad tried to wipe his face and frowned when the tips of loose gauntlet fingers tapped at his visor. He was tired. Hell, only a few hours earlier he had been in fugue, and just a few ship weeks before that he had almost certainly been body dead. He wondered if the world below was Hyperion or Garden. He had been to neither, but knew that Garden was more widely settled, closer to becoming a hegemony colony. He hoped it was Garden. The torch ship launched 3 assault boats. Kassad saw them clearly before the aft camera panned beyond range. He tapped at the thruster controls until it felt as though the ship was tumbling more quickly toward the wall of planet above. There was little else he could do. The squid reached atmosphere before the 3 ouster assault boats reached the squid. The boats undoubtedly were armed and well within range, but someone on the command circuit must have been curious. Or furious. Kassad's squid was in no way aerodynamic. As with most ship-to-ship craft, the squid could flirt with planetary atmospheres, but was doomed if it dove too deeply into the gravity well. Kassad saw the telltale red glow of re-entry, heard the ion buildup on the active radio channels, and suddenly wondered if this had been such a good idea. Atmospheric drag stabilized the squid, and Kassad felt the first tentative tug of gravity as he searched the console and the command chair arms for the control circuit he prayed would be there. A static-filled video screen showed one of the dropships growing a blue plasma tail as it decelerated. The illusion created was similar to that encountered when one skydiver watched another open his chute or activate his suspension rig. The assault boat seemed to climb suddenly. Kassad had other things to worry about. There seemed to be no obvious bailout control, no ejection apparatus. Every Force Space shuttle carried some sort of atmospheric egress device. It was a custom dating back almost 8 centuries to when the entire realm of spaceflight consisted only of tentative excursions just above the skin of old Earth's atmosphere. A ship-to-ship shuttle probably would never need a planetary bailout device, but age-old fears written into ancient regulations tended to die hard. Or so the theory went. Kassad could find nothing. The ship was quaking now, spinning, and beginning to heat up in earnest. Kassad slapped open his harness release and pulled himself toward the rear of the squid, not even sure what he was looking for. Suspension packs? Parachutes? A set of wings? There was nothing in the troop carrier section except the corpse of the ouster pilot and a few storage compartments not much larger than lunchboxes. Kassad tore through them, finding nothing bigger than a medkit. No miracle devices. Kassad could hear the squid shaking and beginning to break up as he hung on a pivot ring and all but accepted the fact that the ousters had not wasted money or space on such low-probability rescue devices for their squids. Why should they? Their lifetimes were spent in the darkness between star systems. Their concept of an atmosphere was the 8-click pressurized tube of a can city. The external audio sensors on Kassad's bubble helmet began to pick up the raging hiss of air on the hull and through the broken blister in the aft section. Kassad shrugged. He had gambled too many times and lost. The squid shuddered and bounced. Kassad could hear the manipulator tentacles tearing away from the bow. The ouster's corpse suddenly was sucked up and out of the broken blister like an ant into a vacuum cleaner. Kassad clung to the pivot ring and stared through the open hatch at the control seats in the cockpit. It struck him that they were wonderfully archaic, like something out of a textbook of the earliest spacecraft. Parts of the ship's exterior were burning away now, roaring past the observation blisters like gobbets of lava. Kassad closed his eyes and tried to remember lectures from Olympus Command School on the structure and layout of ancient space-going craft. The squid began a terminal tumble. The noise was incredible. "By Allah!" gasped Kassad, a cry he had not uttered since childhood. He began pulling himself forward into the cockpit, bracing himself on the open hatch, finding handholds on the deck as if he were climbing a vertical wall. He was climbing a wall. The squid had spun, stabilized in a stern first death dive. Kassad climbed under a 3G load, knowing that a single slip would break every bone in his body. Behind him, atmospheric hiss turned to a scream and then to a dragon roar. The troop carrier section was burning through in fierce, molten explosions. Climbing into the command seat was like negotiating a rock overhang with the weight of two other climbers swinging from his back. The clumsy gauntlets made his grip on the headrest even less sure as Kassad hung over the vertical drop to the flaming cauldron of the carrier section. The ship lurched. Kassad swung his legs up, and he was in the command seat. The display videos were dead. Flame heated the overhead blister to a sick red. Kassad almost lost consciousness as he bent forward, his fingers feeling in the darkness below the command seat, between his knees. There was nothing. Wait. A hand grip. No. Sweet Christ and Allah. A D-ring. Something out of the history books. The squid began to break up. Overhead, the blister burned through and spattered liquid perspex throughout the interior of the cockpit, splashing Kassad's suit and visor. He smelled plastic melting. The squid was spinning as it broke up. Kassad's sight turned pink, dimmed, was gone. He used numb fingers to tighten the harness. Tighter. Either it was cutting into his chest, or the perspex had burned through. His hand went back to the D-ring, fingers too clumsy to close around it. No. Pull! Too late. The squid flew apart in a final screech and explosion of flame, the control console tearing through the cockpit in 10,000 shrapnel-sized bits. Kassad was slammed into his seat. Up. Out. Into the heart of the flame. Tumbling. Kassad was dimly aware that the seat was projecting its own containment field as it tumbled. Flame was centimeters from his face. Pyro bolts fired, kicking the ejection seat out of the squid's blazing slipstream. The command seat made its own track of blue flame across the sky. Microprocessors spun the seat so that the disk of the force field was between Kassad and the furnace of friction. A giant sat on Kassad's chest as he decelerated across 2,000 kilometers of sky at 8 gravities. Kassad forced his eyelids to open once, noted that he lay curled in the belly of a long column of blue-white flame, and then he closed his eyes again. He saw no sign of a control for a parachute, suspension pack, or any other braking device. It didn't matter. He could not move his arms or hands in any case. The giant shifted, grew heavier. Kassad realized that part of his helmet bubble had melted or been blown away. The noise was indescribable. It didn't matter. He closed his eyes more tightly. It was a good time to take a nap. Kassad opened his eyes and saw the dark shape of a woman bending over him. For a second, he thought it was her. He looked again and realized that it was her. She touched his cheek with cool fingers. "Am I dead?" whispered Kassad.